my predecessor in Williams Lake was a lay judge. He was the administrator of a medical clinic, and he was known to be particularly close terms with members of the RCMP detachment. This, in 1973, was just a short time after the Fred Quilt inquest, which you may not have heard of, but back in those days, the Fred Quilt inquest was a big deal. He had presided at the first inquest. There was a judicial review, and that first inquest verdict was set aside, and there was a new inquest, and it was presided over by my district judge. My memory is he was still working on that inquest as I was very newly appointed. But the Fred Quilt inquest was a historic event in British Columbia. But I very quickly became known as an Indian lover. And people who called me an Indian lover were not intending to pay me a compliment. Yeah. And there were some pretty influential people in the William Blake community that called me that. I knew they didn't intend to compliment me. Very, very soon, within a very few weeks of my appointment, I came to understand that Indian children were being scooped in Williams Lake on what I'm going to say was a wholesale basis. And this was 1973, and I know it's called the 60s scoop. But I remember, like it was yesterday, the specific case where I realized that something very wrong was happening. And that case caused me to search out every child protection file that I could find. And my memory tells me there were about 100 of them, and I went through every single one. And there wasn't a single case where the social workers hadn't got the order that they were asking for. And then I remember being asked to go to the Canem Lake Indian Reserve one night and meet with members of the band and the band council there. And I was accompanied by Skip Alton's name. Skip Alton, I mentioned her name previously. She was a really fine social worker, had a senior position in Victoria. She and I went and listened to the people of Canem Lake tell us that there were 30 children, that was the rough number, that had been taken from families in their community, and they had no idea where those 30 children were. And Skip Alton said that she would make it her business to find out what she could. None of those early cases, child protection cases, made it into anything like a reported decision, but in the early 1974, 1975, there were a few, more than just a few little stories in the Vancouver newspapers, but I think more than criminal cases, it was the child protection cases that really shocked me. What had been happening in the provincial court in child protection matters, and I said, this is going to end right now. Mm-hmm. It's not going to end gradually. Mm-hmm. I'm not running a kangaroo court, I'm not going to rubber stamp. And Skip Alton was originally sent to Williams Lake to confront me and to find out what this crazy judge in William Blake is doing, but she and I went on to become good personal friends.
Wow.
So that's kind of my introduction to Aboriginal matters, you know, and I'm well aware that I have a reputation that's well deserved, and I'm proud of it, for being outspoken about Aboriginal issues and Aboriginal rights issues. And I do remember the first Aboriginal rights case that I ever had. It was a man named Francis Haynes, and he was a Chilcotin man. Now, and I'm not good at pronouncing the present name of the First Nation. It's a well-known name, of course. But back when Francis Haynes was before me in court in Alexis Creek, he was charged with hunting a moose out of season without a permit. And he had a very young woman lawyer. Her name was Louise Mandel. And there was much more to his case than either she or I understood. Francis Haynes was a middle-aged Chilcotin man, and like many people from the Stone Reserve where he lived, he didn't speak English. The Supreme Court of Canada had just 1 or 2 years previously said that the government of British Columbia was entitled to require that Indian persons hunting deer out of season or moose out of season would have to get a permit, because those permits were freely given and there was no cost, and they enabled the government to have some idea how many deer and moose were being hunted. After that decision, conservation officers in Alexis Creek put together a policy that had so much red tape accompanying it that Indian people would just give up. And they knew that the answer would, at the end of the day, would always be no. And so nobody bothered asking for these permits. Francis Haynes hunted, got a moose, and I said, well, Francis Haynes, a Chilcotin man, he has a right to hunt moose. And this policy is basically a fraud. And I found him not guilty. My decision, well, I got some hate mail after that decision. Not a lot, but I sure did get some. And I got some people thought it was a good decision. I was appealed to a county court judge. He scorched me for taking judicial notice of some facts, and for saying that this policy was an official policy. And he said that Francis Haynes was guilty. There was an appeal to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal ducked the issue by saying that the proposed appeal did not involve a question of law alone, so they had no jurisdiction to hear it. That case was the only case in which I ever received a brown envelope. And sometime not very long after the county court decision scorching me for taking judicial notice of history and saying that I was outrageously wrong to think that this was a policy approved by the government, I got a brown envelope. The brown envelope contained a copy of the letter written from the Attorney General's Ministry to the conservation officers in Alexis Creek saying, this is a great idea, go for it. That's the only brown envelope that I ever got. I never accepted the notion that my decision in the Francis Haines case was wrong. It was my first Aboriginal rights case. I said Francis had a right to hunt moose. But I did come to understand that the decision was written about 10 years too soon. And so 10 years go by, and a man named Willie Alphonse, a young Shuswap man from Sugar Cane, and Shuswap now, the correct name now is Swepamek. That's my pronunciation is not much better, but by this time the government had some policies about charging Indian people with hunting offenses. And the policy basically required that the charge be approved at a pretty high level in Victoria. But the charge against Willie Alphonse was approved for a couple of reasons. He had impressed the conservation officer as a wise-ass young guy with some white fellows with him. That was the conservation officer's impression. And the other thing was that they didn't think his lawyer was up to the job. And the case was 3 days into trial before somebody in Victoria woke up to the fact that this case may cause a bit of trouble. And they sent up a man from Victoria who said that he was counsel for the Attorney General. That's what he told me, as if he was somebody other than Crown Counsel. And I said, you know, the government's entitled to as many lawyers as they want, but you're not acting separately from Crown Counsel. But his pitch to me in chambers was, the government, the Supreme Court of Canada has said that the provincial court isn't the right forum for these important decisions to be made about Aboriginal rights. And I said, get out of here. If you want to go and stay the charge, you know, Mr. Alphonse didn't ask to be brought to court. The government brought him to court. If they want to stay the charge, go ahead. Otherwise, we'll continue. And I acquitted Willie Alphonse, to nobody's great surprise. And my decision was appealed to a county court judge who was a man who I had a good deal of respect for, and he wasn't a personal friend, he was a professional friend, but he wrote me a private letter and said, you know, kind of, don't be too upset with my decision overruling you. My favorite lawyer says that you were right and I'm wrong. His favorite lawyer was his daughter. There was an appeal to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal said that I was right and he was wrong. And they looked at taking that case to the Supreme Court of Canada, but it was one of a group of cases that the government decided no.
Yeah.
And so the Alphonse case, so then there's one more case that I will tell you about. I told the dean about this case when she and I talked in, I think it was in March of this year in Kelowna. My reputation as being a very outspoken commentator was cemented, and I think that's a proper word, in 1990. Laura Norberg, a young woman with an Aboriginal background, and that fact is not, as I recall it, evident from reading the reported court decisions, but Laura Norberg does have an Aboriginal background. And she had sued Morris Weinrib, a medical doctor, for sexual assault. The case was familiar to me. Laura Norberg had appeared in court before me, charged with so-called double doctoring, and she had pled guilty. her lawyer had said, Judge, this case isn't quite as simple as it seems. I think you need to get a pre-sentence report. The probation officer who wrote the pre-sentence report didn't pull any punches. She said in the report what Dr. Weinrib had done. And I granted an absolute discharge because Laura Nurberg had gone to treatment and she had no previous court history. It was a proper case for an absolute discharge. There was a civil case that followed. She sued Morris Weinrib for sexual assault. The case was funded by the Legal Services Society to their very great credit. And the case was never about a lot of money. Laura Nurberg's trial lawyers were Freeman and Company. And there was a reported decision from a BC Supreme Court justice, you can find it and read it. He dismissed Laura Nurberg's case. He relied upon a case from the Irish courts, which I think even then was known to be one of the most outrageous anti-woman decisions from the courts. The Chief Justice in Ireland had the good sense to dissent. Hegarty and Shine was the name of that case. Warren Arbor's case was appealed to the BC Court of Appeal. And the BC Court of Appeal, you can read the decision. They upheld the trial decision 2-1. I was the author of a very blunt critique of the Court of Appeal decision. It was published in the verdict, and it was titled Marching Backwards. It basically said that the decision of the British Columbia Court of Appeal is marching us backwards to the Victorian era, and it's wrong, and it needs to be appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. And it was appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada, and J.J. Camp, marvelous man, marvelous lawyer, he acted for Laura Nurberg in the Court of Appeal and in the Supreme Court of Canada, and the Supreme Court of Canada unanimously granted the appeal and awarded Laura Nurberg a modest amount of money, and J.J. Camp, talk about pro bono work, this was legal aid funded all the way. He, Morris Weinrib, had been criminally charged. The charge was stayed because he was supposedly dying of cancer. That was a fraud. Didn't die, and J.J. Camp managed to get. He got the money that the Supreme Court of Canada had awarded Laura Nurberg. And one day she opened her mail and there was a check from J.J. Camp for every single cent that the court had awarded her. Pro bono work, you know, lawyers are not all bloodsuckers. Very few, in my opinion, are. I hung up my judicial robes for the very last time in 2011. I'd been a part-time judge for some years before that. I was retired in British Columbia when I reached 70 in 2006. But I continued on for another 5 years as a deputy judge in the Yukon, where I'd done a lot of work since, I started as a deputy judge in the Yukon in 1980 or 1981, and I did a lot of work in the Yukon. But I kept on judging there and in the NWT until 2011. Totally retired since then, but I didn't just fade away into the sunset. During the past 5 years, I've been considerably involved in teaching Aboriginal elders, Native court workers, legal aid lawyers, and report writers. And when I say report writers, I'm talking about persons who were writing Glad You reports or were learning how to go about writing Glad You reports. And I've done that work in some in BC, some in northern Quebec with the Cree people there, quite a bit of work in Saskatchewan. And my outspoken comments in Saskatchewan have not gone unnoticed. If you go online, you'll see that some senior judges in Saskatchewan thought that I was quite wrong in what I had to say about the case of Andy Peekakoot. But I make no apologies for what I said. I do regret the fact that Andy Peekakoot's application for leave to the Supreme Court of Canada was not accepted. But the Supreme Court of Canada can only accept about 5% of the cases it's asked to hear. And Andy Peekakoot's case was a sad one. There were other people, of course, in Saskatchewan who said it was about time that somebody was outspoken about what was not happening in the courts of Saskatchewan. There's been some change in the past few years in Saskatchewan, and it's just possible that I might have motivated some of that change. I'm going to take a moment to say that if there are persons who listen to this interview and have some interest in why it is that so many Aboriginal people in this country get in trouble with the law and wind up being jailed, there's a book that you might be interested in spending a very few dollars. It's written by a man named Mitchell Moisey, whose case is still ongoing in the province of Saskatchewan. He was declared to be a dangerous offender. A Vancouver lawyer, Mariana Jasper, she took his case to the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal, which, to the great surprise of many people, that court said that the Supreme Court, the Queen's Bench Justice, had been wrong in not considering Glad You factors in a dangerous offender case, and he ordered the Court of Appeal, that is, ordered another hearing. That new hearing is still ongoing. It is scheduled to continue for, I believe, 4 or 5 days in October of this year. But Mitchell Moisey has spent a good part of his time while he has been mainly on remand. For 7 years now, he has written a book, and he has written it himself. He had no access to a typewriter, let alone a computer. He wrote it out in longhand in his cell, mailed it to a woman who became his mentor. She's an instructor at the Athabasca University in Edmonton. The book is called Letter to Cody, and it's Mitchell Moisey's book, story, history, whatever you want to call it, written for the benefit of his son, T. telling his son why he should go down a different path than Mitchell, his dad, went down. And it's a compelling read. But, you know, I have said, and I make no apology for saying, that I believe that right across Canada and in every court, perhaps that's not quite a fair statement, because I would not make this statement about the justices presiding in the Supreme Court of Canada. But with that exception, I believe that there are still far too many judges who fail to understand and apply Gladue's sentencing principles. And I have been very outspoken about that in Saskatchewan. There are certainly judges, including the most senior judges in this province, who know my views. But I am going to take this opportunity to tell you that I have been very, very encouraged by the August 4th, 2017 decision of the Yukon Court of Appeal. And the Yukon Court of Appeal, of course, is the British Columbia Court of Appeal with a different name. But the Yukon Court of Appeal, the 4th of August, the decision is Regina versus Joe, J-O-E, 2017 YKCA-13. And that decision corrects a sentencing decision made by a man who was, I said was, not is, a deputy judge in the Yukon. That decision was said to be, by another commentator, not by me, but another commentator fairly widely described that trial judge's sentencing decision as, quote, awful. It was a bad impaired driving case, but the decision of the Yukon Court of Appeal, I encourage people to read it. It is a good decision, and the British Columbia Court of Appeal in 2017 has written some other good Aboriginal sentencing decisions.
I guess one question I'd ask is if you had any advice for those entering a legal career or partway through already, other than to, you know, keep a mind open to Aboriginal issues and to continue fighting.
Perhaps, you know, some of the people that are listening might be thinking that it wouldn't be a bad thing to wind down their lawyering career and see if they could be appointed to become a judge. And speaking for myself, I have never regretted paying attention to my good friend Stu Van Mail, who told me back in early 1973 that I should apply to the provincial court because that's where the action is. And I've been proud to be a member of the Provincial Court of British Columbia during its years of growth and transformation. And I've been proud to contribute at least a little to restoring the rights of Indigenous people in British Columbia and elsewhere in Canada. But that work is still, I believe, far too far from its destination. In 1980, I was chastised for paying attention to historical facts and relying upon judicial notice. I had a very different view of history than had been expressed by the Chief Justice of British Columbia in the Calder case before it went to the Supreme Court of Canada. People should go back and read what the Chief Justice of British Columbia had to say in the Calder case, and to say he was wrong is just much too mild. But nevertheless, the Gladue case comes along in 1999 and tells the Supreme Court of Canada, tells judges that you must take judicial notice of the facts of Canadian colonial history. And the court had to say that even more strongly again in the Ippoli decision in 2012. I have to tell you that when I read the Gladue decision and what the Supreme Court of Canada had to say about judicial notice, oh, that pleased me because I've never forgotten the Haynes case. And I have another memory of the Ippoli case, which is a kind of fun memory. And in a way, it is a bit of advice. It seems to me that many Aboriginal persons who graduate from law schools get snapped up by big companies, by government. They get really good offers. There's a lot to be said for the proposition that more, it would be a good thing if more Aboriginal persons would start out, get some real practice in criminal law. And I said that long before my grandson Thomas, who's gotten stabbed, went to Prince Rupert to Kent, where he's practicing criminal law. But you ask about what thoughts I might have of advice, and I do believe, and many other people have said, that the overrepresentation of Aboriginal persons in Canadian prisons is a national scandal. It's a disgrace, and it's not something people thought maybe it was going to start to decrease after Gladue and Ippoli, but in fact it's still going up. And one reason I believe that lies close to the heart of this is that still too many judges, they don't really understand what has been the colonial history of this country. Mr. Harper said not so many years ago that Canada didn't have a colonial history. It does. And if you read Gladue sentencing decisions, including the good ones, it seems to me that too many judges believe that whatever went wrong just started with the residential schools. It didn't just start with the residential schools. It started long before that, and Aboriginal communities, peoples, their lives were shattered by the coming of white settlers. And it happened everywhere in Canada. In recent days, just in very recent days, following the events in Charlottesville, there's been talk of this in Nova Scotia, should they get rid of the statues of Cornwallis? Mm-hmm. And he was the great Englishman who put a bounty on the heads of Mi'kmaq people. There are more stories of communities that were displaced in British Columbia than people have any understanding of. I know a good deal about the Blueberry First Nation up north of Fort St. John. The Blueberry First Nation, not so many years ago, won a great victory in the Supreme Court of Canada. At least that's what lawyers, us legal people, all think, because their claim was settled for many millions of dollars. But the people of Blueberry do not have that same view of it was a great victory, but they didn't get their land back. Understandable to me. Understandable to you, a lawyer, but not understandable to the people of Blueberry, whose land was, I'm going to say, not stolen. They were tricked out of it in the late years of the Second World War. So the land that they called the place where happiness dwells could be sold to returning veterans to farm. Those returning veterans became wealthy. There is a book written by UBC people called The Place Where Happiness Dwells. It was published 3 or 4 years ago. Great book. The story of the people at Cheslada. If you read BC Studies, the latest edition of BC Studies has in it a really interesting story called Persistence of Colonial Prejudice and Policy in British Columbia's Indigenous Relations. That's in the summer 2017 edition, and he tells the stories of Cheslada and Injinika, or Sekedeni. And those are stories which were pretty recent. And there are other stories. There's the story that is too little known about what happened to the people who lived at Blunden Harbor. There's an absolutely excellent CBC documentary that runs about once a year still about what happened to the people of Blunden Harbor in the 1960s. And these stories are just not well enough known. If I had anything to do with the education that law school students get currently in British Columbia, and I'm not being at all critical when I say this, please, I don't want anybody to misunderstand me, but if I had anything to do with it, law school students would, in their first year, as part of the required Aboriginal course, I would have them going out into communities to meet with the members of those communities on their home ground and talk to people and to hear their perspective of some of these stories, and then to do some, you know, scholarly research too, and write it up. And I think it would be a good thing for everybody, and it would open the eyes of young men and women who are going to become leaders, very real leaders. Maybe some of them will have political careers as well as legal careers. Maybe some of them will have careers as judges after some years of being a lawyer. maybe some of them will be lawyers in big downtown Vancouver firms who will be involved in major transactions that involve an Aboriginal First Nation. And the fact that they're not going to be practicing criminal law, that doesn't mean that there isn't something that would be useful, beneficial for them and for others also. That's really the only message that I would hope that some of the people who listen to this, if anybody does, will take away. And by the way, if anybody who listens to this interview wishes to get in touch with me, they are absolutely welcome to do so. My telephone number is 250-549-3055, and my email address is mcbarnett@telus.net. And Alex, I really enjoyed spending quite a little bit of time with you.
Thank you so much for sharing your history today and about the development of law. And I hope someone takes you up on that offer and has a chance to connect about Aboriginal issues and about anything else that you're willing, that you know, they want to explore.